364 days a year, he's just a crusty old slave driver to a bunch of midgets working under a harsh deadline. But on Christmas Eve, he's Santa Claus' hero to hundreds of millions of kids. 6 days a week, I'm just another crusty old bugger that you wouldn't look at on the street. But on Tuesdays, I'm your Uncle Don, the direst of circumstances. I'm coming to you this 5th of February, 2005, with show number 123. The station is CFUR, located on the beautiful campus of the University of Northern British Columbia in Prince George, B.C. CFUR booms out over the citizens of Prince George at a massive 5 watts, the same as those light bulbs that landlords put in the corridors of slum buildings. The frequency is 88.7 FM. Last week I told you the Royal Canadian Mint annually produces hundreds of millions of pennies, although they are more a nuisance than use. There are 3 reasons for the circulation of the penny. First, it's still profitable for the mint since it costs only 0.8 cents to make one. Second, people are resistant to change. Don't underestimate the power of human inertia. Test it by asking anyone you know how many kilograms he or she weighs. And third, there's popular belief that elimination of smaller change would give retailers the opportunity to sneak in price increases. As for the profitability argument, that carries no weight since the mint is a crown corporation, and as such it follows orders. If the government wants to relieve us of the penny, it's within their power with the stroke of a pen, okay, the keystroke of a computer. People are indeed resistant to change, but if production of pennies stopped, people would begin to hoard them. There are 600 pennies out there for each Canadian, and those would soon disappear from circulation. People resisted the change from the dollar bill to the loonie coin, but they soon accepted the coins when the bills disappeared from circulation. As an aside, the United States tried to follow our example by producing a circulating $1 coin to replace their dollar bill. In spite of massive advertising, the dollar coin failed to catch on, as they did not withdraw the familiar paper bills. The hundreds of millions of their dollar coins now languish in vaults. I admit that the elimination of the penny could result in a bit of inflation as prices are rounded up, but that would be balanced by time saved in transactions and decreased wear and tear of pockets and purses. Australia and New Zealand have eliminated their 1- and 2-cent pieces, and transactions are routinely rounded to the nearest 5 cents. I'm among the many who believe we should eliminate the 5-cent nickel while we are at it, thus making the dollar divided into tenths instead of hundredths. Knock that last digit off all prices, and we would soon become used to using the new pricing. If the Aussies and British could adjust to decimal currency, and those in the Eurozone could adopt a whole new currency, we could certainly adapt quite easily to such a minor change as having only tenths of a dollar. I see only one slight problem in the matter of the quarter dollar. As long as they're spent in pairs, they'd fit into the new system, but singly they would have the same status as what would now be a 2.5-cent piece. Okay, phase out the quarter and bring in the half dollar again. This would leave us with only 4 coins circulating: the dime, the half dollar, the loonie, and the toonie. Why not? There's nothing sacred about the present coinage. We've been subjected to changes before and will be again. When I was a kid, I collected U.S. coins, and my collection contained such oddities as half-cents, 2-cent pieces, 3-cent pieces, and even a 20-cent piece. All of these and others, including all gold coins, disappeared from circulation, and commerce went on unfazed. I'm introducing a contest here. If you want to send me your ideas of what could be done with the 20 billion unwanted pennies and hundreds of millions of nickels if we demonetize them, the prize for the most original idea will be a genuine silver dollar dated the year of my graduation, and that is old. Send your ideas to me at uncledon@cfur.ca or mail them to me, care of CFUR Radio at 3333 University Way in Prince George, B.C., V2N4Z9. I will announce the winner, if any, on my show for the 1st of March, as I will not be here on the 22nd of February. CFUR could use more income. We've applied to the CRTC for a regular broadcasting license to replace our current developmental license. The new license will allow us to increase our power, so new equipment will be needed. But we do not want more income at the cost of taking on commercial programs. If we took that step, we'd be moving toward becoming identical to all the private stations on the radio dial. A recent commercial proposal that would have brought in more revenue was tempting, but it would have changed the complexion of our community radio station. The unique value of CFUR to our community is that it's providing a commercial-free medium for people who are not content to be bombarded with advertising hype. Personally, I believe it should stay that way. CFUR has disc jockeys and commentators who present our shows without compensation beyond that satisfaction provided us by the opportunity to share ideas or our love of music. There are also, of course, certain notorious mouthpieces who have wormed their way into weekly time slots to spread their verbal venom amongst the masses. I mention no names. Uncle Don has no sponsors. Uncle Don has strict moral standards. He is not for sale, period. However, I am for rent if the price is right. If I start to say soothing things about the BC Liberal Party, George Bush, or the CIA, beware. Much of the opinion that you read, see, or hear has been sponsored. Sometimes this is overt, but often financial incentives are hidden. Barbara Emil, the wife of Conrad Black, spilled her views across the pages of the National Post for a salary and various perquisites from her hubby's hobby horse newspaper. She needed no instruction in her diatribes. She knew which side of the bread her butter was on. Other commentators are independents who have following amongst those who respect them. That respect is often misplaced. The following is the opening paragraph of a Globe and Mail article, datelined Washington, D.C. U.S. President George W. Bush vowed yesterday that his administration will stop paying newspaper columnists and pundits to back its policies after the second right-wing commentator in a month acknowledged receiving a contract from a government agency to help promote one of its policies. This promise was prompted by revelations that Maggie Gallagher, described as a conservative columnist, received $21,500 to promote Bush's campaign to convince the poor to marry. Opposite gender only, please. That was on the heels of the exposure of a richer award, that of a contract for $241,000 to Armstrong Williams, by coincidence another conservative, to promote George's No Child Left Behind program, characterized by liberals as No Child Gets a Dime. Since George's pronouncement, there has been one more revelation of payoffs, and there may be many more to come. With that kind of money being spent on propagandists, do you suppose there is any left in the program to spend on poor children? We can trust George to discontinue this surreptitious sponsorship. This must be true. After all, if you can't trust the word of George Bush, who can we trust? Colin Powell? Promises aside, we can be sure that government largesse on both sides of the border will continue to be lavished on friends to promote the politicians' hobby horses. Bush must envy the way the Canadian government was able to get away with spending hundreds of millions of dollars to bribe people to fly our own flag. Down there, they need no prompting to show their colors, so bribery has to be directed to such projects as promoting illegal wars. In the 70s, there was an American scandal when it became public that the CIA had been subsidizing the publications of books favorable to the Vietnam War and other policies of the Nixon regime. These subsidies amounted to many millions of dollars, allowing the distribution of titles that would never have seen print based solely on their merits. American war movies, which are sympathetic to the military, receive support from the Pentagon. If you see a Hollywood war film in which there are lots of soldiers, tanks, planes, and other hardware, count on its supporting current U.S. policies. A film criticizing American wars, past or present, will display a handful of rented Jeeps if they are lucky. So-called think tanks, which have proliferated since the 70s, have been almost exclusively sponsored by corporations and wealthy benefactors. These think tanks spread money around to subsidize books, movies, columnists, radio, and television shows friendly to their right-wing viewpoint. Much of the information which you use to make sense of the world has been tailored and sponsored by the power structure to convince you that this is the best of all possible worlds and that there is no alternative to the globalized capitalist world. British Columbia's contribution to this pack of propagandists is the notorious Fraser Institute. This outfit holds student seminars, which lull students who respond to their siren call of a free session and a free lunch. Some teachers even grant students credit for participation. As one who has attended two of these dog and pony shows in Prince George, I can testify that the Fraser Institute spends lots of money to guide our youth to their right-wing way of thinking. As a former participant, I receive an occasional student magazine published by this Fraser Institute. One issue contained a fawning defense of the free market by one James Moore, then a student at UNBC. Although an undergraduate, he billed himself as having a BA in political science, something of a stretch. With strong right-wing support, this same James Moore was soon catapulted into a seat in Parliament under the banner of the Canadian Alliance Party. Ever since the betrayal of the Progressive Conservatives by Peter MacKay, James represents the Conservative Party of Canada. Anyone of modest abilities like our Mr. Moore can make a lucrative career if willing to sell out to the corporate agenda. A little while back, a Texas stormtrooper pulled a man off the highway and demanded to search his car. So what else is new? Anyone who has met the law in Texas can tell you that the cops there are gods not to be trifled with. If they want to search your underwear, they'll do it on the street. You better shut up, boy, or they'll have you in the nastiest slammer this side of Abu Ghraib. Most of you will recognize the story I'm about to tell. The Texas stormtrooper was east of Vancouver, British Columbia, and he was accompanied by a Mountie. The Texas troopers are training our own RCMP in the finer techniques of spotting drug couriers. The Texas system is so good that they nailed this man and his 2-year-old child cold. Although there were no drugs in the car, you can never be too careful with Vancouver cops. Yes, the man was a Vancouver cop, and he's now suing the Mounties for unlawfully searching his car, not to mention that it was in the instigation of a foreigner. What in hell does Texas have to teach anyone about justice? Isn't that the state where the judges are elected by rednecks based on the number of blacks they hang? Isn't Texas the scene of half the legal executions in the United States? I say we should keep our well-trained Mounties up here and have Texas keep its stormtroopers down there. And I suggest that we find the Canadian idiot who arranged this ridiculous training program, give him a bath in tar and feathers until he looks like Big Bird, then ride him out of town on the proverbial rail. I came up here for Canadian justice, not that southern substitute that manages to incarcerate more of its citizens than any other country in the world, including China. If we need advice from Texas on how to run our police, maybe we should hire Colin Powell as our ethics overseer and Donald Rumsfeld to run our military. It was a good thing that the Canadian government had the sense to sell off our national railway in 1995. Canadian National is now in the sweet embrace of Illinois Central and no longer either Canadian or National. Now they are just CN. It was another good thing when our provincial government decided to betray their election promise to keep British Columbia Railways in public hands, turning it over to the aforementioned CN for a pittance. Before these railways left our hands to become foreign-owned, we were showered with news as to how indebted they were and how impossible it would ever be for them to make a profit. With the newly American CN listed on the New York Stock Exchange, prospects brightened. Suddenly the world was CN's oyster as it fired half its workers from their well-paid union jobs. Likewise with the BC Railway. Mired in debt with bleak prospects, the railway was disposed of just in time for its future to brighten. Suddenly there was talk of a rail extension to Alaska. Then the Northeast coal fields became miraculously profitable, requiring the use of BC Rail track. Now there's a sudden surge in interest in developing Prince Rupert as a container terminal requiring both CN and BC Rail to haul their freight. Isn't it a damn funny that both of these publicly owned railways had no future until they got into private hands? Now they're poised to grow, with a little help. This container port in Prince Rupert already has a little help in the form of $17 million promised by the British Columbia government, and it's asking for a further $40 million from the feds. You ever wonder why these great projects like the Prince Rupert Terminal, which will make so many people rich, never seem to be able to raise the capital to get started on their own? We pay the costs and they get the dividends. Then they bitch that their taxes are too high. Last week I went on about our current conceptions of liberty and freedom. Today I will look at another often used but little clarified term, democracy. Democracy is a concept that we all think we understand intuitively, but when we try to nail it down, it becomes quite foggy. The essence of it is government by the people, which can have many forms. To have all citizens vote on all issues is not democracy, but mobocracy. We therefore choose representatives who are supposedly trust not to trample on our rights when we are in a minority. All existing democratic systems are representative systems wherein the people choose those who will run the daily affairs of government. These representatives must be chosen in elections. It's easier to define what democracy is not than what it is. Democracy is not elections. They are a necessary but not a sufficient condition for democracy, a subtlety unrecognized by one George Wanker Bush. As he said about the situation in Iraq, The notion that, you know, we're not making progress, I just don't subscribe to. I mean, we're having elections. The fact that they're voting in itself is successful. 'Tain't necessarily so, George. There are elections, and there are free elections. Arax is a shining example of what an election should not be. An election, to be meaningful, has to give the electorate a choice between candidates who are truly representative of significant portions of the population. The Iraqi election presented a vast list of candidates not selected under ideal conditions. An election must give all adults an opportunity to vote, free of fear and in secret. The Iraqi electorate was not free of fear, and huge segments of the population were afraid to go near the polls for good reason. If an election has the former elements, it is still meaningless if those selected lack the power to govern independently. Iraqis could have elected the best of candidates with the best of intentions, but they are still only free to do what the occupying army allows. Elections cannot be parachuted onto a people with no tradition of elections. Democracy is likewise a form of government which cannot be imposed, but which must be built on a foundation of freedoms and a widespread desire for that democracy. Iraq has no tradition of either elections or democracy. The culture is based on the authority of Muslim clerics and the rule of dictators going back to the creation of that country by the British, sitting in a distant land, creating countries by drawing lines on maps. Make no mistake about it, the elections in Iraq had two goals. One was to create a subservient government with a patina of legitimacy, permitting it to control the country. This would allow the United States Army to withdraw from an impossible situation. The long-term aim was to create a government that will rule according to American capitalist standards, allowing foreigners to take over the high points of the economy, mostly in the oil business, while allowing the average Iraqis to fill in subservient positions or to sell carpets to one another. It remains to be seen what will become of Iraq if and when the Americans really withdraw and allow the forces within the country to sort themselves out. The American forces will have an uphill battle convincing the country that the invasion and occupation of Iraq was altruistic. Jessica Matthews of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace wrote a piece for the Washington Post last October in which she laid out the Iraqi conception of American actions in their country. She then attempted to refute those perceptions and lay out a path for Americans to follow to allay the fears and suspicions of Iraqi citizens. She did a much better job of describing the Iraqi view than prescribing remedies. And I quote, "If controlling Iraq's oil was not our purpose," they ask, "why was the oil ministry the only building that U.S. soldiers had orders to guard against looting? If the U.S. did not intend to dismember the Iraqi state, why did it dissolve the Iraqi army? If the U.S. did not mean to stay, why is it building 14 enduring military bases? If it did not mean to control Iraq's politics, why would it appoint a prime minister who spent two decades on the CIA payroll? If it is not pursuing a classic policy of imperial divide and rule by exacerbating sectarian differences, why does it continue to insist on minutely balancing Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmen, Christians, and others on every appointed council? Before I buy the altruism of American intentions, I will need good answers to those questions and a few others." I conclude this bit by quoting Pat Roberts, an old-style conservative American senator. He said, "We need to restrain what are growing U.S. messianic instincts, a sort of global social engineering where the United States feel it is both entitled and obligated to promote democracy, by force if necessary. Liberty cannot be laid down like so much astroturf." Canada's a democracy. We're a shining light to the rest of the world. Our leaders are the best of our citizens who selflessly represent the interests of our country. We can trust our politicians not to lie to us. Campaign promises in Canada, unlike the promises of George Bush, mean something. Does it sound like I would blow over 0.08 with a statement like that? I hope you didn't take me seriously. We must recall 9/11 here. Not the noted date in 2001, but 2 years later, when Dalton McGuinty, then campaigning for leadership of Ontario, made a solemn written promise not to raise or create new taxes if elected. The televised ceremony was sponsored by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, a front for corporate interests. McGuinty was elected only to discover a deficit, which he used as an excuse to bring in a hefty health care premium for every Ontarian making more than $20,000 a year. The Taxpayers Federation took him to court to try to enforce his pledge and roll back the new tax. a judge of the Ontario Superior Court, absolved McGuinty of any guilt in breaking his promise, saying that anyone who believes a campaign promise is naive about the democratic system. Although the court's rationale was that politicians have to be free to face changed circumstances requiring difficult decisions, this sucks. If a solemn pledge is made to the electorate, the politician should be subject to impeachment for willfully breaking that pledge. The courts don't want to be mixed up in this barrel of snakes, but surely there should be some mechanism for enforcing promises. In our democratic system, elections are the means by which we hire our representatives. In any other job, falsifying a job application is an offense, justifying dismissal. But in the political realm, a politician is free to tell the electorate any lie, make any promise, and we are stuck with the results until the next election. I think our system requires some drastic reforms here. This is CFUR at 88.7 on your FM dial. Speaking of liars, we should all remember Peter McKay, the man who betrayed a written promise to David Orchard. David threw his support to Peter in the leadership campaign for the Progressive Conservative Party, thus clinching the position for Peter. The written promise was that Peter McKay would not enter into negotiations to merge the PCs with the right-wing Alliance Party. The ink was hardly dry before Peter negotiated the merger that brought us the new Conservative Party, minus the progressive part. It's now public knowledge that Peter has formed a romantic liaison with Belinda Stronach, the multimillionaire daughter of the founder of Magna International. Magna ran against Peter for leadership of the new party. Belinda, having been married twice before, is not unfamiliar with broken vows, but she would do well not to trust any of the sweet nothings that Peter might whisper across the pillows. The man is a snake and will betray any trust that gives him political advantage. 35 years ago, I responded to a newspaper ad that invited immigrants to Australia. On a lark, I applied, jumped through the bureaucratic hoops, and found myself with a visa that was good for a year and an offer by the Australian government to pay 2/3 of my passage. I put the visa away and forgot about it until circumstances in California soured and I was ready for a new start. I had only one problem, my boss. We could never tell him anything, as every subject yielded an argument. If I told him I intended to leave, we would have had a long, drawn-out, and very public argument. So, one day in early January, I went into the boss's office and laid the following on him. At 7 p.m. on the 21st of January, there will be a Qantas plane leaving San Francisco for Sydney, Australia. I will be on it. I left him there with his mouth hanging open, but there was no sound. I made the plane. A year and a half later, I decided, for many reasons, that I was not suited for Australia. Not to condemn the country in any way, but my future there is just not what I envisioned for myself. At that point, a third of a century ago, Australia was quite insular. It was difficult to ascertain what was happening in the rest of the world, including Vietnam, and the U.S. war there in which Australia was participating. Besides this, the national religion in Australia was beer, and I found myself too good an initiate. I could see myself becoming a beer-soaked barfly if I was not careful. In most goods, including manufactures, Australia was then largely self-sufficient, albeit being largely dominated by foreign branch plants. One of their vulnerabilities was in oil. They had some domestic oil, but they were reliant on imports, and they still are. This has colored their international relations, as I shall explain. I'd worked several jobs in Australia, hitchhiked from Cooktown to Perth and back, worked in the territories and in Bougainville, and taken a side trip to New Zealand for a couple of months. I itched to get back to California. I mapped out the usual route north and west through Asia that was being followed by many backpackers in those days. I hitched and bused to Darwin, where I awaited a flight to Portuguese Timor. Along the way, I met Chris and Jenny Green, who were likewise headed up the Gringo Trail to the fabled Kathmandu. We teamed up and went as far as Penang, Malaysia together. It was in Portuguese Timor that I first saw rock-bottom poverty. Most of the villages that we passed through on our rattling bus trip across the island were straight out of the Stone Age and completely outside of the money economy. In Dili, the capital, there was a pileup of travelers waiting for a flight out on the sole airplane connecting Timor to Bali. Dili was no more than a dusty village, but it was the seat of the colonial government, and it had an economy and some infrastructure. The Portuguese administrators did not want the town unduly influenced by these strangers, so they provided a three-sided shelter on the beach, where we all stayed as long as we wanted, for the princely sum of $1 Yankee. No one took advantage of the extended hospitality, as there was nothing to do in Dili and nowhere to do it. While staying in the shelter, dubbed the Hippie House, I learned one of these facts of the facts of traveling in poor countries. No one has any change. If you don't have the exact change for a purchase, you are expected, as a rich foreigner, to eat the difference. I cashed a traveler's check with a Chinese merchant, only to find the large bills could not be changed. I decided to go to the main post office in the capital and buy stamps for postcards. They claimed they could not break a bill that was the equivalent of about $15 U.S. Each Timor left a lasting impression on me. I was shocked when I heard that Indonesia had invaded and occupied the country shortly after it gained independence from Portugal. What could Indonesia possibly want with that impoverished land and its poor citizens? The answer is clear now. Why do poor countries get invaded and occupied? Oil. The Timor Sea is rich in oil. Australia cut a deal with Indonesia to split the undersea's riches to the detriment of Timor. Now that Indonesia has reluctantly yielded this half of the island to Timor, they are using their leverage as a rich power against the immediate needs of Timor to force concessions on the rich oil fields lying within Timor's claimed 200 nautical mile limit. John Howard's right-wing government is playing hardball, and few seem to notice. Timor has its independence, so what do they want? We all have more important things to do, like spending tens of billions of dollars chasing an invalid living in caves. I despair that the world will ever achieve peace, the peace we need as a foundation for justice in this world. The coming peak in world oil production seems to herald in an era where there will be terrible injustices committed in the scramble for this declining resource. May the gods help us all. As you may have guessed from the wave of advertising touting zero-interest loans and cash incentives, the North American auto industry is in some trouble. I was staggered when I read that the domestic automakers have an excess over their desired inventory of 400,000 vehicles. This came out in an article in the Economics of Fleet Sales, particularly those to rental companies. I never gave much thought to how big the auto rental industry is, as my usual exposure is to see a half dozen rental cars at the airport. But Dollar Thrifty plans to buy 205,000 rental vehicles this year. Vanguard Car Rental, which owns National and Alamo, bought 200,000 GM vehicles last year. Traditionally, the auto industry would unload surplus vehicle stocks on fleet buyers with deep discounts, but they found that this is a trap. By loading fleets with large numbers of cars, they depress future used car prices. The average rental is sold after 6 to 18 months, thus hitting the new market with competition that limits what automakers can charge for future models. I was just struck by the sheer size of the vehicle fleet market, of which rentals are a small part, and how today's business decision can come around to bite a company in the seat. This has been your Uncle Don, the direst of circumstances, coming to you with rant number 123 on this 8th of February, 2005. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Just last month, we celebrated the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. Now, who will liberate Guantanamo?